Welcome. The second installment in the New Development in Theory lecture series. The series aims to bring scholars working on the cutting edge of theory broadly understood to Basel. And broadly understood means just that, that is, ranging from metaphysics to politics, from literary theory to economics, from psychoanalysis to the sciences, and what have you. But the only criterion for this series is that it be cutting edge. So I trust it will become evident that our guest tonight easily fits this criterion when we will listen to his talk in just 1 or 2 minutes. In fact, just attending to a few of his scholarly credentials already tells us as much. It is thus my pleasure to introduce Stuart Elm, Professor of Political Theory and Geography at the University of Warwick, and Dimonash Warwick, Professor in the Faculty of Arts at Monash University. To date, he has published 5 monographs and 7 edited collections, unless you have edited another 1 or 2 in the last 2 or 3 days or so. This is correct. In addition, he's one of the editors of one of the leading journals in the field, Environment and Planning in E-Society and Space, as well as a frequent blogger, taking up all sorts of themes from developments in theory to very concrete political events on his blog, Progressive Geographies. You should check out that blog also because that's where many of his writings are available to download. Since he's such a prolific writer, let me just mention his 2 latest monographs. In 2009, he published Terror and Territory, the Spatial Extent of Sovereignty with Minnesota University Press, and most recently in 2013, The Birth of Territory with Chicago University Press. This latter book received the 2013 Association of American Geographers Meridian Book Award for, and I'm quoting, outstanding scholarly work in geography. In his work, Stuart Elm focuses on the intersections of philosophy, politics, geography, literature, and history, specifically with respect to concepts such as space, territory, knowledge, and power. Accordingly, he has written on a diverse range of thinkers who have taken up precisely this conundrum. Thinkers such as Heidegger, Foucault, Lefebvre, Kant, Sloterdijk, and Axelos. Since he's tireless, or so it seems, he's currently at work on 3 new projects simultaneously, one focusing on and outlining Foucault's last decade, another one on Shakespearean territories. That one takes up some of Shakespeare's plays with respect to how territory plays out in them. And finally, in a 3rd project, he's concerned with rethinking geopolitics. We will get a taste of his latter project in his talk tonight, I believe. The talk's entitled Geopolitics, Geopower, Geometrics. And I'm very excited that he is here tonight, so please join me in welcoming Professor Stuart Elm, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Thank you for the invitation. It's very nice to be here. And I'm going to try and talk about this project that I've been trying to work on for the last few years, and also to tell you a little bit about why I think I'm stuck, where I don't know quite where to go with this work, and why this will be useful to have a dialogue and discuss some of the ideas that I'm trying to work on around this. Because in the last few years, I've been trying to think about the idea of the globe and to try and relate that to 2 other terms, the world and Earth. And it seems to me strange still that while globalization is a topic of concern in a wide range of disciplines, across the social sciences, across humanities, the relation between globalization, space, and territory still doesn't seem to me to be really worked through in detail. At the same time, in philosophy, there's a lot of very interesting work about the concept of world, and yet how that relates to the economic, political, cultural phenomena across the surface of the globe is sometimes rather detached. There doesn't seem to be too much of a link between that philosophical work on world and the work on globalization in variety of forms. And where philosophical ideas have been put to work in thinking about globalization, often I think that's been done in a way that isn't terribly helpful or has some problems theoretically. One of them would be the use of the idea deterritorialization out of Deleuze and Guattari's work, to use that to describe globalization as if globalization is unmaking territory or changing territory fundamentally. But what I think is really happening is a remaking of spatial relations. I don't think everything is the same as it was before, but nor do I think that territorial relations are unimportant entirely. So the continuities between perhaps the modern state territorial system and what we have today under globalization can't be understood very well because the conditions that made one possible are not fully understood. That we don't really have a theory of territory that would allow us to make sense of deterritorialization or re-territorialization. Now, I began doing this work by working on philosophers around the question of the world, and Metin Heidegger was a key figure in this, and then figures that come after Heidegger. Eugen Fink, the book Spiel als Weltsymbol, play as the symbol of the world, or the game as the symbol of the world, and particularly Kostas Axelos' book Le Jeu du Monde, the play of the world, or the game of the world. These still seem to me to be crucial philosophical resources for thinking about the world and what Axelos calls mondialisation. And he wants to draw a distinction between that and globalization. And he suggests that globalization is a kind of mondialisation without the world, that the world gets forgotten as we go to the notion of the globe. Now, the French were talking about mondialisation back in the 1950s. I'm not sure when in German this term became a current term, but in English it was really the 1980s, beginning of the 1990s, that globalization started to be talked about. And how do you take that work forward, not in an abstract philosophical register, but in a more political register? Well, it seems to me that the French Marxist sociologist Henri Lefebvre does some interesting things with this, particularly in a French four-volume book called De l'État, of which in this States-based world collection, Neil Brenner and I translated some parts that we thought opened up some of these questions for thinking about the world, but thinking about the politics of that particular process. And then recently, Peter Sloterdijk's Spheres trilogy, now being translated into English, it's been available in French for some time, but the potential resources in there for thinking about some of those questions, and various other thinkers I was thinking about in relation to world. And a whole set of questions came up for me about how we might conceive of the world and about these processes of becoming world or transformation, the ways particularly that this might be understood in relation to questions of globalization, what might be called regimes of global calculation, thinking about the calculative processes that are going on, a sort of a mechanistic, technocratic way of thinking about space at that world scale. But it didn't seem to me to be necessarily going very far, and I couldn't quite work out what I was doing with some of those questions, and I was trying to think about this in terms of the space-territory-globalisation relation, of how globalisation was in some sense a kind of an acceleration or an expansion of a calculative way of thinking about space that was initially related to the nation-state, but is increasingly being related to the globe as a whole. And I was trying to work out what sort of distinction there was between these processes, how we might think about those kind of questions. But it seemed to me to run into a dead end. I wasn't entirely sure how to take that work forward. And so I've recently been trying to think about this from almost another direction, which is to think about the notion of geopolitics, and that's really what I'm going to talk to you about tonight. Geopolitics, it seems to me, is generally seen today as big politics. Global politics or international politics. But the geo element, the earth or the world or the globe, that seems to me to be somewhat neglected in thinking about geopolitics. And that was the question that I was interested in. Could we rethink geopolitics with a focus back on the geo element, the earth, the world, the globe? And might that be another way of thinking about some of these questions that I was interested in? Geopolitics then today often seen as effectively global politics. And I wanted to say, well, if it is, then we need to really interrogate the notion of the global. But better, perhaps, I think, let's start with the notion of the geo itself, the earth, as an object for analysis there. Geopolitics then does literally mean the politics of the geo, the politics of the land or earth or planet or world. And all of those terms I'd want to think about in distinction from each other, not trying to collapse all of the meanings together. So here what I'm going to try and do is say something about the notion of the earth in relation to those questions. Now, earth is a complicated term. It's complicated, I think, in all the languages that I have some awareness of. English is interesting because it has three roots into the language in English of where this word comes from. And I'm going to read the whole of this passage, but this comes from the philosopher John Salas. And what he's trying to talk about here, it's mainly in the second part of this quotation. He says that in English at least, the term Earth works in at least three registers. One is planet Earth, capital E, Earth. Another one is the idea of a planet such as Earth, of which at present we only know of one, this Earth, but could potentially apply to multiple planets or multiple homelands or multiple ways of thinking about the Earth in that sense. The third one is the element Earth, out of the Greek understanding of fire, water, air, and earth as the fourth of those elements. And he's suggesting that all of these relate into each other and that these are tangled up in their meanings. And I think this would be the same, certainly in French and German, around how we think about those questions. But the longer version of this paper does some of that sort of etymological conceptual history work with this concept of earth. I'm not going to go into the whole detail about that, but what's interesting, I think, in English is that we have the three different roots into the English language for words that relate to the idea of the earth. One of them is the one that I guess most of you will be familiar with, which is the Anglo-Saxon Germanic notion of erde, into earth. The way that that comes through in the English language, through time of Beowulf, the term being used to plenty of places in the Beowulf poem, coming through into modern English as one of the sets of words that we have around this idea of earth. The second root into English of these kind of words is the root that gives us words like terrestrial, terrain, terra, and so on. And that's the French, and this is filtered through the Norman invasion of England in the 11th century. So it's a Latin through Norman French root into the English language of those words. So you have Germanic and Latinate roots in English. But the other one is the Greek roots. The term geopolitics, geography, geometry, and so on comes from the Greek into the English language. So we have these three different roots into the language for these words. But it seems to me that in all of them, and particularly in those terms like geography, geology, geometry, geopolitics, we're somewhat losing that sense of the earth, the geo itself, in those terms. So geopolitics, as I suggested, becoming global politics, geometry as an abstract branch of mathematics, geography is no longer earth writing, the literal sense it was for the Greeks, but is a fairly loose sort of spatial sensibility to questions that might otherwise be done in international relations, in sociology, in cultural studies, and so on. And perhaps it's only in geology that we keep that sense of the earth in the original Greek way of thinking about that term, and that geology, as really what has become, certainly in English language universities, increasingly earth sciences, a particular way of looking at the earth in all of its multiple aspects around those kinds of questions. What I want to try and do here is to hint at some of the ways we might retrieve that earth sense in geopolitics and in geometrics, how we might rethink the earth in those terms. Now, if you go back through some of these history of ideas approach to some of these questions, you can recognise, I think, even as early as Aristotle, that there is a recognition of this separation between the way that we talk about the things and the actual relation to the earth itself. So in the Metaphysics, Aristotle says, geometry differs from measurement of the earth because the latter deals with what we perceive, whereas the former deals with the unperceived. The former deals with the abstraction of geometry as a branch of mathematics, rather than perhaps actually going out into the fields and measuring the earth in that kind of sense. So Aristotle is already starting to create, in a sense, the detachment of geometry from the physical earth itself, and that this continues through the history of geometry. If you go up to, say, the analytic geometry of Descartes, 17th century, this is becoming an increasingly abstracted branch of mathematics away from the earth itself. Now, those different etymologies in English, the different roots of the terms, have political resonances in a range of ways. I'm not going to go into those in detail here, but what I'm thinking of is the way that earth is, and this is, I think, particularly a concern in German, sometimes tied to a fairly reactionary politics of a recourse to the earth or blood and soil ideas, and the nationalism that sometimes goes with an appeal towards that earth. And you can see this in a variety of linguistic and political contexts, the notions of fatherland or motherland, the notion of the promised land, the holy land, Eretz Israel, land of our fathers, all of these having complicated political elements in this appeal to an earth or a home or a ground for a particular set of politics. And so there's a whole set of complications around this, and I'm well aware of those, and it's to try and steer away from that reactionary politics. Could we rescue this potential, but for more progressive political purposes? You can find that reactionary sense if you go back to Greek myths of autochthony, the idea that the founding figures, the founding fathers really, and there is always a gender analysis there, the founding figures in Greek thought, or Greek politics really, sprung forth from the soil without the mediation of an actual human mother, the idea that the original kings of Athens grew from the soil of the particular place where Athens was situated, the myth where the teeth of a dragon were sown in the ground, they were planted in the soil, and warriors sprung up. This is the founding myth of the city of Thebes, the dragon warriors that founded that city. And then in Plato's Republic, the idea of the noble lie, the idea that if you can lay claim to the fact that the original people from this political community didn't come here from elsewhere, that it isn't sort of random that they happen to be in this particular place, but that they were born from the very soil itself, and this is why you can lay claim to this particular place. You can find that in modern day Israel with the idea that this is the promised land and that this particular place is crucial to the Jewish state project of modern Israel. So then a geopolitics that is a politics of the earth rather than the globe might very easily collapse back into that reactionary politics. A whole range of people that might be related to that kind of idea. Carl Schmitt's Nomos of the Earth might be looked at as a potential around that. Carl Schmitt, of course, was a member of the Nazi Party and a jurist, a legal scholar on behalf of the party. Geopolitics has some fairly unsavoury figures in its historical past. So Friedrich Ratzel with the notion of Lebensraum. Martin Heidegger's distinction between earth and world and his reimagining of autochthony in thought, of thinking about concepts that are rooted in a particular place, in a particular soil, not so very far from here in the Black Forest. Carl Schmitt suggested is particularly interesting or problematic around these questions, talking about a legal way of thinking that is at once a legal way and a division of the earth. Nomos is both a law and as a division. Nomos, he says, is the measure by which the ground and soil of the earth in a particular order is divided and situated, also the form of political, social and religious order determined by this process. So it's about thinking about a particular location in a place, in a soil and an earth, that gives rise to a form of political order around these questions. Now Heidegger, I think, is interesting around this because Heidegger starts to talk about some of these questions in the 1930s at the same time that he's allied to the Nazi Party, he's a member of the Nazi Party, becomes rector of Freiburg University as an official Nazi appointment of that university. At the same time, he's appealing to works of art, such as his painting by Van Gogh. Heidegger takes this to be a pair of peasant woman's shoes. The story is that these are probably Van Gogh's own boots that he used for walking in a city, but Heidegger wants to think about this in relation to a particular rural location, and then he tries to imagine the way that you can think about the woman that would have worn these and the connection that she would have had to the soil, to the earth of the place that she was. I'm not going to read through all of these passages, but it was one of Heidegger's examples about how you can think about these questions and that this could give rise to this idea of autochthony in thought, or what he calls Bodenständigkeit, of a rootedness in the soil of the concepts that we use to make sense of these kinds of questions. And earth comes through in some of Heidegger's other work, in his reading of the poet Herderlin, talking about the idea of a different measure of the earth. Is there a way that poetry can give us a sense of a measuring of the earth, perhaps a different geometry, that isn't rooted in a simple calculative mechanistic way of determining and ordering the world that Heidegger thinks is problematic for all sorts of reasons? Is there a different way that Herderlin's poetry perhaps has resources for thinking about those kinds of questions? Now, the reason that's interesting is I think that Heidegger uses this as the way he engages with politics in the 1930s, the way that he tries to make sense of his own political involvement in the Nazi Party. So The first lecture course that he gives on Herdman is 1934. He'd become the rector of Freiburg University in 1933 and had resigned in 1934. He first starts talking about Van Gogh's Peasant Shoes in 1935, and it continues to work through his work into the 1940s and beyond. Even if he's trying to distance himself from the way that the Nazis were thinking about blood and soil, Brut und Boden, and the Nazi notion of a Volk as a racially determined category, for Heidegger there's still a deeply unpleasant, I think, nationalist politics behind some of the things that he's trying to think about with these questions. And this sense of a claim on a particular area, particular soil, rather than simply a territorial claim without a specific location for it, can be found in a whole range of contemporary political issues. So you can find this in Argentina claiming Las Malvinas Islands, which the British called the Falkland Islands. You can find it in the contestation over the West Bank. You can find it in other contested territories across the world, such as Western Sahara or Kashmir, and self-determination movements the world over are looking for a particular location for the politics that they want to constitute. So this is the great worry about this idea of earth politics thinking, the thing I'm trying to think about here. Does it seem destined to replicate all of the worst gestures of colonial, settler, aggressive, and expansionist geopolitics, as geopolitics has been practiced in the past? But the question that I'm wondering is whether there are resources to think other than that, to think outside of that reactionary right-wing kind of way of thinking about these questions. Are there resources, even perhaps in Heidegger's work, but particularly in Deleuze and Guattari's work on geophilosophy, and especially, which I'll talk about today, Elizabeth Gross's work on geopower? Can we use those to think about politics differently? Can we, as I suggested, use Heidegger differently? In one of my previous books on Heidegger, a book called Speaking Against Number, I tried to work through some of those political questions in relation to Heidegger. And the title of the book, Speaking Against Number, is both a phrase using language against calculation, but each of the words are also the chapters of the book. The first chapter on speaking is on rhetorical politics, on politics constituted through speaking and listening in a particular language community. The second is on against, or what I call polemical politics, of how politics is contestation and is struggle. And the third is on this idea of number or calculative politics. And the argument is to try and think through different ways Heidegger thinks about politics. And in the last of them, what I think is Heidegger's critique of modern politics as a whole and the problems that he identifies with modern politics around those kinds of questions. How Heidegger thinks about what he calls technology or machination as a particular determined way of thinking about politics that you find both in Americanism, in Bolshevism, but also in National Socialism as a particular way of thinking about politics that has got us into so many of our contemporary political problems. And Heidegger does this in part by thinking about how the world has been overdetermined by what he calls a calculative way of thinking. That if you look at somebody like Descartes' work, Descartes doesn't just write a book on geometry, which is extremely important in the history of geometry, but he says that geometry is also the science that allows us best access to the material world. The material world, the fundamental characteristic of the material world for Descartes, is that it is extended in three dimensions. Extension then becomes the key determinant to space and the objects within that space, and geometry is the science that allows us to understand extension. So the idea, I don't know what they're called in German, but in English we call them Cartesian coordinates. X, Y, and Z, you plot on a graph. These come from the way that Descartes thinks that geometry is about reducing geometry to number, and numbers that can be plotted on a two- or three-dimensional grid, which is the way that you understand the material physical world. That reduction of the world then to calculability is something that Heidegger finds in a lot of contemporary politics. He finds it in both left and right-wing variants in Bolshevism and in Americanism, capitalism effectively. But he also finds it in 1930s Germany, the idea of Gleichschaltung, the coordination or same wiring that was a big Nazi project at the beginning, the mechanisation of things like the five-year plans with the particular targets and yields that were aimed for in terms of how productivity and self-sufficiency was aimed at, the total mobilisation, the 5 and 4 year plans and so on. So that's one possibility that we might use Heidegger to critique the very thing that he himself was complicit in terms of his membership and political activism within the Nazi Party. Another one might be in terms of what Deleuze and Guattari think about, this relation between what they call deterritorialization and reterritorialization, and the way that we might think about that, not for me in terms of simply a deterritorialization, which you can find in a lot of literature on globalization, but the reterritorialization, the continual making and remaking of political spatial relations, and thinking about the transformations that are going on, rather than the idea that, as some business school gurus of the 1990s suggested, the end of the nation state, the end of territory, the end of borders, that these things in globalization were no longer as important. For me, the interesting thing is, how are they being remade? How are they being transformed in new ways? Rather than thinking that they're fixed, but more thinking that they're unimportant. The re-territorialization then being stressed around this. And Deleuze and Guattari take this forward with the idea of what they call a geo-philosophy, which has been picked up, for me, most interestingly, in Elizabeth Gross's work. And I want to say a little bit about her work on this question. So it's in a book called Chaos, Territory, Art, Deleuze and the Framing of the Earth. And she makes, I think, an interesting distinction between earth and territory, which is the initial reason I came to it, because of my interest in the question of territory. For Elizabeth Gross, territory has something added to the earth. The earth has been framed. It has qualities. It's been ordered. It's been constructed. So here's the quote on the screen. The frame is what establishes territory out of the chaos that is the earth. The frame is thus the first construction, the corners of the plane of composition. With no frame or boundary, there can be no territory. And without territory, there may be objects or things, but not qualities that can become expressive, that can intensify and transform living bodies. Territory here may be understood as surfaces of variable curvature or inflection that bear upon them singularities, eruptions, or events. Territory is that which is produced by the elaborate, if apparently useless, activity of construction, attention-grabbing, and display that mark most sexual selection. So for Gross there, and it comes through in that very last line there, there's a kind of vitalism to this, a vibrancy to thinking about these questions. And for her, territory and body go together. Both of them are framed and ordered. Territory and body, she says, only emerge as such to the extent that qualities can be extracted. Now that part of her work, the vitalism, is where I would want to take some distance from these positions. But the idea that we can think about territory as a process, territory as something that's been transformed through particular actions, that I think is really helpful. And it relates to some of the work I've tried to do about thinking about territory as not a simple concept, but as something that's inherently complicated because it's a bundle of a whole different set of relations, a whole wide range of different relations. I've tried to think about these in political, economic, strategic, technical, and legal senses. Now, I think that Deleuze and Guattari don't necessarily use territory, territoire in the French, in the same way that Anglophone or Francophone geographers use the term territory. I think there's a distinction there to be made. But I do think that there's something interesting in what Gross is doing here with this notion of territory, particularly in the way that it relates back to this question of earth. So a couple more passages from that book. There's only earth, she says, rather than territory, until qualities are let loose in the world. Qualities and territory coexist, and are thus both the condition for sexual selection and for art making, or perhaps for the art of sexual selection and equally the sexuality of art production. And so Darwin becomes a key figure through a lot of her thinking around this alongside Deleuze and Guattari. But it, for me, it's the what is done to earth to become territory rather than the kind of vitalist vibrancy that's interesting in this. The earth, she says, can be infinitely divided, territorialized, framed, but unless it is in some way demarcated, nature itself is incapable of sexualizing life, making life alluring, and so on. But it's this framing, for her, is how chaos becomes territory. Framing is the means by which these transformations take place. Now, my suspicion is that this work, Elizabeth Gross's work, has been picked up more in literature and aesthetics than it has until recently in geography. Only recently have geographers begun to engage with Elizabeth Gross's work. But I think what's interesting in there is this potential for thinking a more kind of active sense of the geo in geopolitics out of this way of thinking. Maybe then extension into this notion of geometrics. A lot of what she's talking about here is these notion of qualities, things that can be set out, that can be measured, that can be understood through these processes of transformation. Now, Elizabeth Gross was invited to the big American Geography Conference in 2012, and one of the things that she did there was to propose a term of geopower to think about these questions. This is a term that some geographers in the audience said, you know, why didn't geographers think of this first? Geopower, it's such a great term. Why is it that it was a philosopher, literary theorist who came up with this term before the geographers to think about this? So what does she say here? And this, for me, is a really helpful distinction. The relations between the Earth and its various forces and living beings, and their not always distinguishable forces, are forms of geopower. If power is to be conceived as the engagement of clashing, competing forces. Power, the relation between humans, or perhaps even between living things, is a certain historically locatable capitalization on the forces of geopower. Now that sense then of the power of the Earth, of geopower, would open up a whole range of more than simply human relations to think about. The power of natural processes or resources, the dynamics of human and environment, the interrelation of objects outside of human intervention, the relation between the biosphere, atmosphere and lithosphere, the complex interrelations that produce, continually transform and rework the question of territory and state spatial strategies. Some people have picked up on this again following from Deleuze and Guattari. So Manuel de Landa with the ways that this might be thought through in the book A Thousand Years of Nonlinear History. The literary theorist Jonathan Bate looking at the way that poetry can retrieve a connection to the earth. John Protevi, a philosopher and a French literature scholar in America, talking about what he calls the hybrid multiplicity of geo, hydro, solar, bio, techno politics. All of these things complicated and intertwined in relation with each other to make sense of these kind of connections. And Jane Bennett, who I'll say a little bit more about in a moment, retrieving an active earthy sense to what she calls vibrant matter, of thinking about matter not as inert and as something that is always having things done to it, but the inherent vibrancy of that in itself. Now, this is where I go down a kind of slight Foucault detour before I come back to where I'm thinking about this. Foucault's work on biopolitics has been extremely important in a whole range of fields and has been picked up and used in a number of different ways. But what the relation between biopower and biopolitics is, I think, has been somewhat unclear in some of the ways that this has been adopted. Matthew Hanna has suggested that biopower is the wide set of any power to do with human or other life, and that biopolitics is a kind of subsection of that that's to do with particular ways that is directed towards particular purposes, a narrower set of questions within the wider field of biopower. That, I think, then is useful for thinking about how we think about geopower. Geopower is the broader category within which geopolitics operates. So within that wider thinking of geopower, perhaps then we can situate this geopolitics as a politics of the earth. And that, for me, that geopolitics in that sense would sit alongside biopolitics rather than be an either or, one or the other. Now, Foucault's work on these questions from the Society Must Be Defended lectures through to the most recent English publication, but it's been out in French for a couple of years, on the government of the living, which is Foucault's course on the early church. Foucault opens up these questions of the government of life, of which biopower is a particular determination about that. But it's really this relation between biopower, biopolitics, and what some people have called biometrics, either through an analysis of these or through the particular way the biometrics are used as a set of measurements of the body for surveillance and security purposes and so on. Now, the literature on biopolitics and biopower is enormous, going from Foucault's work, but also through to Giorgio Agamben and Roberto Esposito, Harton Negri, Dylan and Reed, and so on. Biometrics, I think, so far has had less attention around it, but somebody like Louisa Moore, my past colleague at Durham University, has opened up some questions about bio-measuring, different ways in which the biometric passport or the biometric border, different ways in which the body and various traces of the body are measured, evaluated, and become political issues. So that's the sort of Foucault detour, but this then comes back to this question for me of geopower. If we have biopower, biopolitics, and biometrics, there's also a threefold relation between geopower, geopolitics, and geometrics. Geometrics then understood in a traditional sense of the term, earth measuring, rather than the way it's been understood as this abstract branch of mathematics. Now, we're told in the historical tradition about how this is. In Herodotus, in the Greek histories that Herodotus writes, he talks about who he calls the original earth measurers. These were Egyptians. These were the people who every year were sent out into the fields by the side of the Nile to remark out the boundaries between the farms. Because the Nile floodwaters had washed all of these boundaries away, you needed people who could go out and measure the fields to allow the right property to go back to the right farmers. And what Herodotus tells us in this story is that this becomes the model for the more Greek abstract sense that you can find, particularly in somebody like Thales, but then it comes through into Euclid, into Aristotle, and so on around these, of turning the very practical field measuring into the very abstract mathematical model, and then the history of geometry from that point there onwards. But there are traces of that throughout the Western tradition, and in the book I wrote on the question of territory, one of the ways that I try and make sense of territory is not just as this fixed container within which political things happen, but as itself produced by these processes and transformed and continually produced through those kinds of processes. And a lot of these are technical. For a long time, I toyed with this as the title of the book, The Geometry of the Political, the earth measuring of the political, in a sense, the way that these connections interrelate with them. That I was trying to think about territory in a broader sense than simply a political or geographical question, but these different kinds of elements within it. It's to do with legal mechanisms and technical land surveying, cartographic practices, census projects, as much as it is to do with the simple land or the terrain in and of itself. And various examples that I use historically to try to illustrate some of those practical, technical ways of thinking about this. So, for example, the Roman land surveyors, the Corpus Agrimensorum Romanorum, the body of writings of the Roman land surveyors, and particularly Frontinus's work, but the practical way in which they would understand the division of a farmer's field, and then the way that this would get scaled up into larger scale Roman imperial projects for extension into the lands that the Roman army conquered and then became part of the imperium, the extension of Roman rule. There was also a very interesting, I think, 14th century scholar, Bartolus of Sassoferrato, who writes very important political legal texts around the question of the relation between jurisdiction and territory and so on, but also wrote this work on the Rhone River, the Tiber, which he claims that he wrote when he was on holiday, and that he was walking along the side of the Tiber River, and he became interested in some, we would now today call them geographical questions, but the legal implications of these questions. And the three questions were, what happens if the river changes course and washes land from one side of the river onto the other bank of the river? Who owns the property, the land, that is created by that process? Or if an island emerges in the middle of a river, who owns that island? And the third one, if a river dries up, who owns the rights to the dried up riverbed? Now, those questions are not ones he makes up for himself. You can find them in the Byzantine Emperor Justinian's Institutes, where these are the three property questions that arise from rivers. And these are crucial questions today. So many international boundary disputes are around rivers and around precisely these kinds of issues. But what Bartolus does is what you can see possibly in these fairly crude diagrams, is he tries to answer this not just by legal arguments, but by geometric arguments. He tries to draw out how you could apportion the land fairly between at the time, it would have been two landowners, two farmers, who owned the fields on the two banks of the river, and how you could actually think about dividing this up equitably. So it becomes, in a sense, a kind of a work of legal geography or legal geometry. You use the practical land measuring alongside the legal arguments to resolve these kinds of questions. This is the sense of geometrics that I think is important to think about in these terms. Now that then, I think, opens up a potential for ways we might think about this question today in terms of contemporary issues, ways that we might understand natural resources and the measuring of the yields of oil and gas, of minerals, the way we understand questions of soil fertility and agriculture, the way we measure things around air quality and pollution, and so on. And lots of people have done work that I think is helpful in opening up these kinds of questions. So Phil Steinberg, the work on the ocean, but particularly I'm interested in what Phil is doing with the question of ice, of taking ice as a geophysical question that has important political implications. And particularly with climate change, ice is becoming, I was going to say a hot topic, of course it's not a hot topic, but an important topic in international relations. Part of the reason is because ice is not a static geophysical property. It fluctuates with temperature, and so you have issues such as the Northwest Passage in the north of Canada. You have issues such as the Arctic seabed that may become accessible. You have all sorts of shipping, fishing, mineral rights, and so on questions. And he's suggesting, just as we have a law of the sea to go alongside territory law on land, do we need a law of ice to take into account the particular geophysical properties of ice to make sense of these questions in terms of borders, in terms of resource politics, and so on. Similarly, work on river boundaries today, Bartolus is an example back in the 14th century, but this is important today. Rivers as a political boundary are a terrible thing to choose for a political boundary. I mean, the Rhine River here, of course, is a good example of one that's been understood at various points in the past. The Roman Empire trying to expand up to the Rhine River and then trying to go beyond, but never quite managing to secure land on the east bank of the Rhine. But then also the Rhine is important between France and Germany at different times in terms of the politics of that line. But rivers are not a fixed property of a landscape. Rivers are a dynamic feature of the landscape. Now you have some places, such as the Rio Grande between US and Mexico, where they put it into big concrete channels to try to keep it where the river should be, so that the river matches where the political boundary actually is. But in many instances across the world, the river changes course, but the line is supposed to remain where it is. So you then get not a farmer part of his field washed up on the other bank, but literally a part of one country's territory washed up on the other bank, or that the river has moved and the boundary hasn't changed. So the political and the geophysical here, complicated interrelations around these kinds of questions. Sheila Krupa's recent book, Hotspotters Report, is a wonderful book about the legacy in the landscape of military and particularly nuclear uses of a particular place, the impact that this has, toxic waste on landscapes and bodies. Similar in a way to the work Rachel Woodward did in a book called Military Geographies. And she said the traditional way of understanding military geographies is, how does geography impact on the military? How does a military strategic thinker understand the fact that if you're going to use heavy artillery or tanks, you need to have soil of a particular resistance, otherwise they'll sink into it. This is one of the problems in the North African War of tanks getting stuck in desert sands and so on. If you want to fight a battle, then you maybe need to take the hilltops because this is the strategically powerful place to be. Rachel Woodward turns this around and says, not what is the impact of geography on the military, but what's the impact of the military on geography? So she's looking at a lot of planning and testing areas where the military have worked in the past and the legacies this has for the physical material landscape of these kinds of questions. Then there's a load of work on oil. Oil as a resource, but also the physical material marks in the landscape of oil. It's not just the oil extraction, it's oil distribution. And so people like Matthew Huber, looking at ways you can write what he calls a kind of an eco-politics or a historical ecology of capitalism and American-style neoliberalism. Various other works that have done similar things along those kinds of lines. Or work, this is the last of these examples, on the geopolitics of food. The book, this is an older book, Geopolitics and the Green Revolution, looking at the ways that in countries in the Cold War tried to use the way that they determined agriculture and their agricultural production through genetic breeding as a measure of national security, so that they weren't reliant on other states. And there's a whole range of other people that are doing work that I think relates to these kinds of questions. Saskia Sassen's work on land grabbing particularly, or what she calls the disassembling of national territory. So land grabbing is a thing where lots of states in the continent of Africa, or particularly in South America, are allowing vast portions of their land to be taken either by other states, so China is doing a particular amount of this, or multinational companies, selling these, renting these at very, very low rates, and allowing the resources to be exploited from those places. It's being called kind of colonialism China style, of a different way of thinking about those kinds of relations. How does that get measured? What's the different political economies and calculative sets that are going on around those questions? So in terms of Foucault, just as I think Foucault is misjudged historically, suggesting that population replaces territory as the object of government, I think that historically doesn't work as an argument. I think, too, there's a risk today that people are pushing this idea of biopolitics rather than thinking about geopolitics alongside it. For me, it's keeping the two in relation that's important around thinking about those kinds of questions. The ways that we think about the object and constitution of population are, I think, exactly the same kinds of techniques that are used to understand the object and constitution of territory. Understanding territory as a process rather than simply as an outcome, as a technology rather than a container for political action. And today, the very techniques that are being used to transform the way we think about politics in relation to populations, so this idea of biopolitics, I think these same kinds of things are going on in a more kind of physical geography kind of register. These calculative techniques, modes of measuring and controlling that we find in things like land surveying, terrain analysis, cartographic practices, administrative strategies, statistical surveys, legal codes, financial techniques and military technologies. It's the calculative metrics that I think is important to try and grasp in both of those registers, the bio and the geo, around those issues. Now, one of the things I've tried to do, this is a paper that is published, that I hope is part of this larger project around this, is, and this is partly a self-critique as much as it's a critique of other people, is to suggest that one of the ways that we've traditionally understood territory is very much as the way it's represented on a map, what might be called the cartographic imagination, a very flat way of rendering an image of what the world is. And I've tried to think recently about how we might think about territory in three dimensions, of thinking about height and depth as much as about the flat way of understanding these kinds of questions. Now, I was looking at this in terms of security, and I was thinking about territory as a volume rather than simply territory as an area. But I was trying to break away from simply thinking about the vertical going up or down. And I was trying to think about the way that it spreads out in those three dimensions, the way that it fills these areas becoming volumes. So how do we take account of questions about airspace, subterranean, so tunnels, bridges, different ways of thinking about space in more than simply the way that it's represented on a simple map. And I was inspired by a number of people in this work, but one of them was by Eyal Weissman's work. I'll go on to this first. Eyal Weissman wrote a very interesting book on Israel's occupation of the West Bank called Hollow Land, the Architecture of Occupation. And on the front cover of the book, he has this place, which when I visited the West Bank a few years ago, this is my photograph of this. What you have here, this is the linking an Israeli settlement in the West Bank back to Jerusalem. You have an Israeli road here, which is up on these elevated platforms and has high walls either side of the road to protect the road. That's the fast route between these places connecting in the West Bank. But along here, you have the Palestinian road on a different dimension, vertically. And the Palestinian road connects different places than the Israeli road would connect. And so you have what Weissman talks about is the superimposition of different geographies on top of each other. And he says the way that people have traditionally understood the geographies in the West Bank has not really made sense of the complexities in those three dimensions of the way that we understand this. It's not just about bridges and elevated platforms, but it's also about aerial surveillance. It's about what happens underneath the surface, the tunnels, and so on. And there are various analyses in his book of different places in the West Bank where these issues become extremely important. If you know about the site of the Temple Mount, where there's the wall of the old Jewish temple and then the Al-Aqsa Mosque on top, there are tunnels underneath, which the Israeli claim is that these are tunnels that are part of the foundation of the old temple. And so you have the superimposition not of territories meeting like this, but territories meeting like this, of the idea, and this was proposed at the Camp David agreement, or the Camp David talks that didn't lead to the agreement in 2000, of Palestinian sovereignty on the surface, but Israeli sovereignty underneath the same place. Now, that way of thinking about sovereignty as layered opens up this question of how we think about territory in three dimensions. So in this paper, on volume, I tried to work through some of those questions. And Eyal Weissman's work was very useful for me in thinking about this, of breaking with the two-dimensional, thinking about the three-dimensional. He's recently been doing work on what he calls forensic architecture, of this idea of forensic archaeology, in a sense, of how you dig beneath the surface to interrogate some of these questions. So he did a piece on Josef Mengele's skull, so the Nazi figure, and then how could you identify this person through a project of trying to do the DNA testing and the different techniques that are needed to understand the complexities of some of those questions. So what am I trying to do with this? I'm trying to think about how the materialities of space become important in how we think about territory. The territory too often, I think, is detached from the geophysical. We don't think about the geophysical in those relations. Now, if we take the Arctic as an example of those kinds of questions, this is a map that my old colleague Durham from the International Boundary Research Unit did to try to think about how we might map the contested claims to the Arctic from all of the different Arctic states. So from Denmark in relation to Greenland, from the US because of Alaska, from Russia, Canada, and so on, about how you might lay all of these different claims and how different people are claiming this. Now, the problem of this map, great as it is, and I think it does represent with all the detail and the key and so on, it does show the complexity of the territory sovereignty relations there. What this shows, though, is only one slice, the surface of how you think about these. And if you start to think about the territorial sovereignty relations, but you start to add in that materiality, then you start to open up a greater degree of complexity around those kinds of issues. If you think, you may have seen relatively recently, Russia or a Russian submarine planted a flag on the North Pole on the seabed, laying claim to the idea that the seabed at that point formed a continuous landform to a part of Russia. And so that under the surface of the sea, you could draw this idea that Russia extended that far. Canada has also claimed the North Pole, but Canada's claim is more on the idea of a continuous on the surface ice up to the North Pole, and that the North Pole is kind of Canada's backyard in a sense. The US is laying claim to this, not because it wants to claim any of these as territories, but it wants to claim these as a passage that it can use as a quick route from the Atlantic to the Pacific at times of year when the passage is open. Now, if you think about these in terms of the simple two-dimensional, I don't think you get all of the complexities of the geophysical in those kinds of relations. So it's about thinking about these questions, but it's also about thinking about them in terms of the kind of calculative politics around those ideas. Let me come on to conclude with talking a little bit about the idea of the Anthropocene, which people have talked about as almost a new era in geology of the human impact on this, of the human impact of the extraction of resources from the subterranean in terms of the impact on these on the atmosphere. And the way that we might think about some of those questions here. Now, Simon Dolby, who's a political geographer in the United States, sorry, in Canada, thinking about some of these issues and talking about the need for what he calls a geopolitics of climate change. Now, what I'd want to suggest with thinking that and thinking alongside Simon Dolby's work is that we need to think very seriously about the geo in the geopolitics of climate change. We cannot simply think about the international politics of climate change. I think perhaps the international politics of climate change would look at, well, you know, the US always fails to sign up to the treaties, and China and India are continuing to do these things, and it looks at the international relations in how this pertains to the question of climate change. The geopolitics of climate change, I think, would push much more and talk about the politics of the Earth processes that are triggered by the mechanisms of climate change. How do we think this at a more kind of material, physical, geophysical sense of these kinds of questions? So if we think about these in relation to a whole range of contemporary political questions that would relate to climate change and other questions, risk, security, prediction, aid, sustainability, development, finance, the economy, population, many of those could be read simply in the way Foucault does the question of biopolitics. But I think we also need to think about them in relation to this geophysical, the question of earth, land, world, global. Not simply as the frames within which these things take place, but as the very things over which these things are actually having their impact. The spaces within which, between which, over which those kinds of regimes, those political regimes, operate, shape and calculate what's being done to them as objects of transformation and possibility. So alongside of biopolitics, attention to geopolitics, but not in that loose sense that I began with of global international politics, but a politics of the earth. Thinking about this within that wider frame of what Elizabeth Gross calls geopower, that engagement of clashing, competing forces, some of which are human, more of which are living, and many of which are what Jane Bennett calls vibrant matter. Or what might be called, and I came up with this phrase, I don't know if any of you have read this, a wonderful, very peculiar book. The best description I could think of it was animate objects as opposed to inanimate objects. Objects that do things. Objects that are, in a sense, the way Jane Bennett talks about them, vibrant. There's some vibrancy or agency almost imputed to the objects in these questions. Go back to that suggestion I gave you a while back of Elizabeth Gross, thinking about how geopolitics as the particular human element is within this wider frame of geopower, the clashing competing forces, and so on. Power then, geopower, geopolitics perhaps, as a particular way of thinking within that wider set of framing. Or as the political theorist William Connolly has put it in his most recent book, one theme of his book is that the planet, indeed the cosmos, is replete with self-organizing spatio-temporal systems flowing at different speeds, levels of sophistication, and degrees of self-sustaining power. These impersonal systems are open to some degree and never in perfect equilibrium. They interact with each having a degree of entanglement with several others. And alongside that emphasis on calculation, of reduction to number of modes of measure that can be understood through biometrics, what about the techniques of calculation, operations of measure and control, which are directed towards the earth, to the geo? That broader, I think, retrieved rather than invented sense of geometrics that would include, but not be reducible to, the abstract art of geometry. I think that would help us to make sense of these regimes of calculation in their relation to global politics or global governance. And that as a way of thinking about the politics of the Earth, would ultimately hope to be appropriate, to be sufficient, to start to think through the complexities of the Anthropocene, especially in terms of what Simon Dalby goes on to call Anthropocene geopolitics. In that, at least, I think we need to really insist that the geopolitics has that sense of the geo-privileged within it, even beyond how it's been understood in critical geopolitics. To put this another way, why is Simon Dalby not Anthony Giddens or John Urry, both of whom have written books on the politics of climate change? There's a real importance to a geographical perspective to the most geographical of political questions, that of climate change today. So that's what I'm trying to mean by a regrounding of geopolitics, a rethinking of the ground, the earth, the geo element in those political questions. And William Connolly's developed this by talking of a need for thinking through the relation between political economy and environmental issues, especially in the light of what he's developed in his other work of A Politics of Becoming. He says, to come to terms with the looping relations between capitalist production, carbon and methane emissions, state policy, consumption practices, glacier movements, and climate change sets the stage to link political economy regularly to the behaviour of non-human force fields. So if political geography, or geopolitics, broadly understood, is to live up to the promise of its name that has that geo element there, then I think it's crucial that it is involved in just these kinds of debates. Thank you.